This meeting of the House Resources Committee will now come to order. It is now 1:25 p.m. Friday, January 30th, 2026, in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Colomb, Representative Hall, Representative Mears, Representative Prox, Representative Elam, Representative Sadler, Co-Chair Representative Dibert, and myself, Co-Chair Representative. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phone for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole and Andrew Gianotti from Records and Zach Lawhorn from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. Today in Resources, we are holding introductory hearings on two bills, House Bill 247, Climate Change Response Fund and Grants from Representative Josephson, and House Bill 258, Statewide Spay and Neuter Program from Representative Stapp. The Department of Environmental Conservation is on the line to answer questions about both bills on the agenda today. And the Department of Fish and Game are also here on House Bill 258. So first up, we have House Bill 247 from Representative Josephson. This is the first hearing on this bill in House Resources. Representative Josephson, welcome to House Resources. Please join us at the table and begin your presentation.
Thank you, co-chairs and committee. I'm Andy Josephson, House District 13 itself, Midtown and Anchorage. With me is my staff, Joe Meehan, who has a PowerPoint and is prepared to help me and answer any questions we hope that you have. I want to thank you for the opportunity, Chairwoman, to present this bill. This bill, we think, is vitally important. We don't dispute that it can be considered provocative, certainly in terms of its funding source, but we think this is where the world is going, and we think we can show, unfortunately, that that's true. House Bill 247 is an important reform to the way in which the state pays for disaster relief. Recently, legislative research reports that the state has spent $361 million during the last 20 years on disaster relief funding. Now, that may sound, well, at one level it's bad, divided by 10. Perhaps it's only in the range of, you know, $20 million per year. But as you will see, the trend line on these expenses is not favorable, and the state's cash position is worsening. For example, looking at just 1 year, in House Bill 53, the operating budget for fiscal year 25, last year's operating budget, arguably 2 years ago, the state needed to spend $29 million just to supplement what had been funded for disaster relief in that single year. So to give you an illustration, and you'll see that this happened 2 years in succession, the legislature in that year appropriated, in FY 25, appropriated $20.5 million. The governor vetoed $7.5 million, leaving the account with $13 million. But it had to be supplemented because of disasters, declared disasters, by $29 million, making the entire year's appropriation $40 million. And as I learned yesterday, we call it the entire year's appropriation, but often these books remain open. So, for example, yesterday I learned from DMVA that the costs associated with the 2018 earthquake are not closed. They're not finalized. So these things can fester and go on. In the current year, FY26, the appropriation was funded at $23.3 million. Just as he had in the previous year, the governor vetoed $10.3 million, leaving the appropriation at $13 million. But now, in our supplemental bill, the governor has asked for $40 million. Of course, a lot of that attributed to Typhoon Halong, for a total cost of $53 million. And you'll see that in the PowerPoint. The unfortunate trend is there. You can see that our funding is wholly inadequate and is a huge imposition on the overall budget. Note that in FY22, the state spent nearly $60 million on disaster relief. That was the year of Typhoon Murbach. Our state budget can no longer sustain the growing cost of disaster relief, nor deal constructively with its erratic and unpredictable nature. Interestingly, I had research up in the Terry Miller building help me with some of these numbers, And they provided a link to a report for the general for the GAO in Congress. And that report is called The Unmet Needs of Environmentally Threatened Alaska Native Villages. This report was prepared by the ANTHC, the Tribal Health Consortium. That 200-page report concludes that our 229 villages, 144, quote, face some degree of infrastructure damage from erosion, flooding, and permafrost degradation, and a perilous combination of all three. The report in question, which I'm happy to get for you, concludes that there is an $81 million annual funding gap to meet unmet needs in rural Alaska. Importantly, we've all heard the mantra that a penny today is worth a pound of cure is relevant to this report. So the report notes that, for example, investment of $1 in hazard mitigation saves $6 in recovery costs. Extrapolated, the report concludes that if we funded at $80 million a year, we could avoid over time, and I can find that time, $25.8 million. We've all heard about these sorts of statistics. So it's certainly easier to do the mitigation and preparation in advance. Now to the bill. The bill adds a new law in 4355-400 to create a new 20 cent per barrel surcharge. Now that's where the pain is, and no doubt we don't suggest it's not provocative. It will be provocative because the industry currently pays 5 cents per barrel for prevention and response through the Spill Prevention and Response Fund, and it's paid that amount for a long time. So there's a familiarity for the industry with it. There was a 95/100 of a penny surcharge, actually tax increase, added to the motor fuel tax, which was designed to buttress SPAR as well. That's paid by you and I and not so much directly the industry. But the industry is used to the 5 cents, and it makes the argument that it's contributing to the cleanup of spills it didn't necessarily cause. For example, a dry cleaning site that has had a leak. SPAR may come in there, DEC, and do a cleanup. And that's certainly not a direct cost associated with the industry. But, you know, fundamentally, even though we all enjoy energy to heat our homes, to fly to other cities, to fuel our cars, what's sort of obvious about this bill is that there's a connection between the burning of fossil fuels and climate-related disasters. So HB 247 would add 20 cents per barrel surcharge. These funds would go to the general fund and be available for a new climate change response fund noted in Section 9. Folks available for that fund would be NGOs, tribes, municipalities, and the like. DEC would administer the funds. There are alternatives to DEC administering the fund, and we'd be happy to talk about those as well. Eligible organizations could apply for those funds. I would note that a question may arise about, in the worst-case scenario, don't we get relief from FEMA? I think we're going to learn that in some instances FEMA does quite well, although there's lots of literature, we can share this with you, that as you know, if you watch the news, and I know you do, the future of FEMA is very, very uncertain and unclear. And in addition, sometimes the state does not get, for example, the 90% it craves in compensation from the federal government. It may get 75%, which sounds great until you're talking about tens and tens of millions of dollars. So we believe that this surcharge is appropriate to apply in throughput, since, as I noted, science supports that the burning of fossil fuels is the main culprit. Just a couple other comments. The bill, as I noted, would free up revenue so the state could use that revenue for other important functions. I'm reminded by staff upstairs that actually this concept of effectively taxing throughput does not originate with this bill, but actually the state in 1967 had a disaster relief fund generated from an establishment of a $10 capitalized initial fund. 1967 legislature established a $10 disaster relief tax on employed persons and a 1% disaster oil production tax. So they used the production tax to fund disaster relief back then. I just want to read one thing and I'll close. It's from the report I noted from ANTHC. And here's how their executive summary begins. Today, and mind you, this bill is not just for rural Alaska, but they write, today, Alaska Native communities are on the front lines of climate change. These communities are disproportionately impacted by harmful climate-driven environmental trends and extreme events. Alaska Native economic, social, and cultural ways of being, which have served so well for millennia, are now under extreme threat due to accelerated environmental change. The magnitude and severity of this problem can be difficult to comprehend. In jeopardy are not just buildings, but the sustainability of entire communities and cultures. With that, Madam Chairs, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you have. We then have a PowerPoint from Mr. Meehan. We have invited testimony from Dr. Steiner, a leading scientist in this area.
Thank you. I had Representative Elam.
Thank you. Thank you for presenting here today with us. I guess my first question is can you help me to understand the difference between a surcharge and kind of a tax? It sounds like a 20 cent per barrel tax, but you're using the term surcharge. Is it? What's the difference between a tax and a surcharge in this scenario?
I could obfuscate and dodge, but there's virtually none. The current term in law is surcharge. And when you're talking about SPAR and its spill prevention response funds, it is imposed in law as a surcharge. If somebody, for example, a member of the press said, isn't this a tax, I'd say, yeah, it's essentially a tax.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
How much revenue do you anticipate generating from this particular tax?
Through the chair, and I apologize for not saying that before, the fiscal note is consistent with what we thought, and that is around $33 million a year. I think Dr. Steiner will tell you, not without cause, that that may not be enough. And I've just read some statistics from the last two fiscal years that support that it isn't. And this report from ANTHC says it isn't. It says we need $80 million a year. But I think that it's important that we understand this is no longer just, I'm tempted to say, sort of a nuisance account that we fund 15, 18 million a year. This is 40 million in the last 2 years or more and growing. This is now a major component of our budget.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler, then Representative Prox.
Thank you. I understand this is for the initial presentation, and I want to let the sponsor have the opportunity to make his case, but through the chair. The sponsor, it's the front, acknowledges the controversial nature of the bill, and that's just fair, really. But to me, this is based on the premise that climate change, the purported reason for the fund, is anthropogenic, caused by man, and specifically caused by oil. And on the basis that there should be some nexus of cost causer, cost payer, even though we don't have dedicated funds, what evidence do you offer to justify a $30 million program that the oil that passes through the Trans-Alaska pipeline justifies trying to address climate change?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, what Mr. Meehan and I didn't do, he may be able to. Mr. Meehan is a scientist as well. He would be embarrassed to hear that, but he worked for Fish and Game on their critical habitat and sanctuary program for decades, and so he's exposed to a lot of this information. Every day I read about the nexus between those two things, and Joe and I did not prepare you couldn't bring enough documents in here to make the case. You would run out of room in this room, right? So we didn't prepare for that specific answer. I think Dr. Steiner, off the cuff, could do a much better job.
Representative Prox?
Yes, I guess I would like to hear the rest of the presentation, but will there be time allotted after the presentations to bring up some of these questions?
Absolutely. I think so.
Madam Chair, just as a preface, Dr. Steiner will note probably that recently, I think in the last year, the state of Hawaii, which is often a leader in this area, particularly on, for example, it's trying to get 100% clean air renewables, right? I think that Representative Mears may know something about that as well, but about Hawaii's efforts. But they've recently passed a $33 million surcharge.
Yeah, if I may interrupt, I didn't mean that to extend the debate. I'd prefer to hear the rest of the presentation and then debate the question with more information.
Madam Chair,
will there be time after the presentation?
Madam Chair, if I might.
Representative Josephson.
Whether there's time is up to the co-chair. I wasn't providing anything to add to the debate. I was just noting that Hawaii has a $100 million tax on mitigation and disaster relief imposed on its principal industry, tourism. And Dr. Steiner will tell you in the research to it, well, the literature supports that other states are doing this as well.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Josephson. Seeing no further questions, if you'll proceed with the presentation.
Mr. Meehan.
Madam Chair, for the record, Joe Meehan, aide for Representative Josephson. And I'd like to briefly go through House Bill 247 and some of the details that Representative Josephson hit upon. Clearly, our climate has changed with the floods, mudslides, avalanches, coastal and riverine erosion, various sorts of storms, loss of glaciers. Wildfires, certainly it's in the headlines constantly, reminders to us. Many of us have likely been impacted by these severe weather events over the years. Despite Mr. Warner's wish, or perhaps his suggestion, HB 247 would not change the weather. But what it would do is establish a fund to help Alaskans mitigate and abate climate impacts. It would be funded by a new oil production surcharge. It would authorize the Department of Environmental Conservation to administer a grant program. And lastly, it establishes a process and criteria for awarding those grants. To gain a general idea of the financial impacts of these severe weather events on our state, we looked at climate-related state disasters, declared disasters, between 2004 and 2024. In that time period, there were 78 climate-related disasters declared in Alaska, 10 of which were due to wildfires. During that period, there were $233 million state dollars spent on those disasters. In addition, another $367 million federal dollars that were spent on those disasters. And just as a side note, for non-disaster wildfires during that time period, there was just over $1 billion spent fighting those wildfires. That included both state of Alaska funds and federal funds. And looking at those disasters over time, the red line that you see on this graph indicates the number of disasters through the years, 2004 to 2024. You'll see the highest number of disasters declared in any one year was 2002 with 13 of them. The bars on this graph represent the funds that were expended on those disasters, the blue is state funds, the green is federal. And both in the numbers of disasters each year and the funds spent are represented by the black trend line on this graph. And if we were to extend that trend line out into the future, which most scientists and people involved in climate change discussions and research indicate, it's going to keep climbing into the future.
We have a question from Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair, to Mr. Meehan. So going back to the last slide or two. So I don't believe that our disaster declarations necessarily include wildfires. So I think maybe some of them are, but from a previous slide, but wildfires that aren't disasters is, again, another chart that adds on top of this. So this is only part of what we're dealing with, and we're seeing those wildfire trends also rise over time as we're having climate change and effects on our forests.
Representative Muir, through the chair. Yes, that is correct. Only 10 of the 78 declared disasters since between the time period 2004 and 2024 were wildfires, and many more wildfires that were not declared state disasters.
Representative Klum.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair. So I'm not understanding your black trend line. So, I mean, it doesn't go on top of the highest. It's not, doesn't put the lowest in context. 24 had hardly anything. I'm just wondering, how did you draw that black line? What was the basis of the trend?
Representative Colum, through the chair. That's a statistical line that, to be honest, Excel puts into the program, mm-hmm. In all likelihood based on a regression analysis. Mm-hmm. And I am not the statistician, so I can't go any further than that to explain it. But it basically looks at the variations for each year and trends over time.
Yeah, I was just looking. I don't know. It doesn't really look like it's going up. It's going like this, depending on the year. So I just wanted to see if that was based on actual statistics or. Thank you.
Please proceed.
So going into some more of the details of HB 247. It will amend AS 43 to add a new surcharge of 20 cents per each taxable barrel of oil and would be deposited into the general fund. It also creates a climate change response fund within the general fund, and the new surcharge may be allocated to the new fund. As Representative Josephson said, we anticipate $33 million annually to be generated from this surcharge. Based on the fiscal note from Department of Environmental Conservation, approximately 4% of that fund would be used by DEC to administer the fund. And lastly, this portion would establish rules for reporting and paying the surcharge. HB 247 also amends AS 4446, which would amend the duties of DEC to administer the new fund and also administer the Climate Change Response Grant Program. Lastly, it establishes a process and criteria for administering the grant program. Some details of the Climate Change Response Grant Program. It would be open to non-governmental organizations, political subdivisions of the state, and tribal governments. It could be used to build, repair, upgrade, or improve capital assets or other infrastructure. It would establish eligibility criteria by the applicants to meet a threshold for anticipated or real risks from climate change. It would also, the applicant would have to secure and maintain adequate property loss insurance and have a preventative maintenance plan. DEC would set priorities based on these criteria, which would include protect and improve public health, protect and improve climate change resiliency, and to mitigate environmental damage and loss of life and property caused by adverse weather events and climate change. So in summary, HB 247 is a proactive approach to protect our communities, infrastructure, economies, environments, and lifestyle. As has been noted, studies have shown that for every $1 spent proactively, saves $6 in response. A 2017 study contracted by the Denali Commission found 144 communities in western and interior Alaska face high or moderate risks of infrastructure damage from natural hazards. And our cited figures only reflect declared disasters. Impacts from climate-induced factors are likely much higher. And as also been pointed out, the future FEMA funding and assistance is uncertain, highlighting the need for this fund and grant program. And with that, we would be happy to answer any more questions.
All right. Representative Prox.
Thank you. I think it's important to note you mentioned that every dollar spent returns $6. And that's on average, I guess, maybe, but it's not true. It's if you, because this is a problem with FEMA and everything else that is taken away from consumers. A dollar spent over here might not do any good. And a dollar over here might do 100-to-1 return in the future. Have you thought about that management part of it? Does that make sense? That every dollar spent, that's a misconception, or not the right way to look at it.
Through the chair, it hasn't been my misconception as a 61-year-old person, whether it's exercise, whether it's car repair, all of those typical things we engage in life. My experience is that a smart investment is the early investment, and that you avoid and forego other costs. Mr. Meehan cited to one source that said it was 6-to-1. This document from ANTHC also cites 6-to-1. It cites to a second document called the Multi-Hazard Mitigation Council 2019.
Right.
So, I assume that if there had been a better investment in protecting Kwagilinguk and Kipnuk, they would have survived in better shape.
Before you continue, Representative Prux, we heard a presentation from Brian Fisher when we, in a tribal affairs and joint meeting that we had, was that yesterday? The days all blend together. And that was what he also stated,
right.
6-to-1. Mm-hmm. If you spend a dollar in mitigation or in preparedness before a disaster happens.
Right.
But go ahead, Representative Cox.
Why it's important is if you were an insurance company, you would, and FEMA is basically an insurance company, that the money is disconnected from the customer. If you were an insurance company and you wanted to insure somebody's house, you would charge a different rate for somebody that's located in a flood zone or near a river. Similarly, a good example is if you want to insure an auto, the auto insurance rates in Juneau are considerably higher than the auto insurance rates in Fairbanks. Why? Because there's more accidents in Juneau. Why? Because there's hills and snowy and icy streets and narrow roads. But the insurance companies look at where their cost is driven. And they don't just raise the rates for everybody so that they can cause more people to locate in areas that are higher risk. And my main objection with this approach to it is that I think we do have to respond to the changing climate, I'll call that. But if we just continue to replace things and not associate the cost of replacing something there, we're going to spend way more than is necessary to respond. And then that money couldn't be spent somewhere else. That's the fundamental flaw with the approach that we have here. And then we'd have to get into, we said this was a surcharge and it's dedicated to climate change. Well, have you answered the constitutional question of a dedicated tax?
Just, if I might, through the chair, Representative Prox, on the second point, it is not dedicated, it's designated. So
No. I understand that. Semantics.
No,
yeah.
If I might.
Yeah. You can. Go ahead. But we're not going to agree.
Representative Prox.
I'm sorry.
It's not semantics because, as we saw with the Higher Education Investment Fund, which I hope to replenish, these funds can be used for other purposes.
Representative Colon? Yeah. Are you done, Representative Prox?
Yeah, we're not going to win that one. So,
yeah, my questions were similar to that. So, through the chair, Rep. Josephson, I would say before I ask my question, you know, in your introduction, you stated that we enjoy our energy, but no, this is life and death for Alaskans. We need energy to keep our houses warm. It's not like we're just enjoying it. We actually need energy to keep our houses warm. So I take a little issue with that. I understand there's some flexibility with some of the energy we use, but I think we're all aware that the oil companies, LNG, those things are giving us a stable base load. So anything that would, you know, disincentivize more production or business investment, I'm a little, you know, wary of that. But I wanted to ask about the way it's set up. So I guess my two questions are, so you created this new climate change response fund. Why not just put the money in the disaster relief fund? Why create a new one? And I guess maybe this, you answered this, but basically they don't have to use it for climate change. They can, it looks like they can, they may appropriate it to whatever the state want. Like we could move the funds around, but if it's really supposed to go to this one mission, just curious on how you set up the fund and why you set it up that way.
Through the chair, my use of the word enjoy was only meant to mean we all benefit from. So none of us have clean hands when it comes to burning fossil fuels. Very, 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 very few of us. These funds could be directed by committee substitute or amendment to the disaster relief fund. This was modeled as a surcharge that would be in the hands of the spill prevention response agency, which is a division within DEC, and it was designed to, I suppose, provide a little more directed purpose as to the intent of the fund. There's nothing really that would prohibit what you're saying. Mm-hmm. So those are my thoughts.
Okay. And one follow-up? I'm thinking of Santos. They're net zero. The whole mission of their company is that. And they're actually kind of being punished for something that they're not contributing to. What do you do with a company like that?
Through the chair, I'm aware of their Australia board's directive. Mm-hmm. And I think they're involved, for example. They're interested, I think, in things like the carbon offset program. Mm-hmm. I guess I would need some evidence that they've actually reached that goal. Mm-hmm. I appreciate they have that goal. That's credit worthy.
Well, they were in our committee just not too long ago and said they were. So that's why I brought it up.
Well, it would be a difficult carve-out to use in this bill and would be, I think, begrudged by other contributors. But I take your point. Mm-hmm. I haven't given it any thought beyond that.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Sadler, then Representative Mears.
Thank you. I need to come to the defense of my colleague from North Pole that it's true. We are constitutionally prohibited from dedicating funds with a couple notable exceptions, and we tend to deal with that by having designations in the budget, which I'm sure you're well aware of, and we have special funds that may be used for the announced purpose, but which also may and are used to divert to other purposes, and the sponsor listed some. I'm concerned that this is a rather large dipping into the revenue stream of the pipeline to provide another such a skirting of the borrowing dedication. Therefore, my concern that those who might view this as seeing the oil industry and the pipeline as deep pockets for anything will see much justify that fear. I want to be respectful and hear the presentation, but it's going to be a big lift to try and get me to take $33 million a year for an ill-defined thing to provide money to grants to NGOs. Sorry.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Mears?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm processing that a little bit, but I think I'll take my stand my earlier tack. So through the chair to Representative Josephson, I think your role here as the operations budget co-chair for finance, I'll take advantage of that knowledge. So you'd mentioned as an example that we already have surcharges and other funds that we use for an associated purpose. So the spill prevention response, generally for similar purposes as the money's being generated from, but there's other ancillary uses. Our vehicle rental tax, we just got out of our DNR budget finance subcommittee. We utilize the vehicle rental tax for our state parks, amongst other things. So I'm sure you've got many more examples of how we have ancillary things that we use funds for. So to me, looking at tying a per barrel oil surcharge to climate change, there are certainly non-anthropogenic sources, volcanoes being, you know, towards the top of the list. There are indirect anthropogenic sources like wildfires that are further spurred by climate change. But fundamentally, oil, natural gas are large. Oil is large chain carbon. When combusted, carbon dioxide, natural gas, CH4, methane. There's decades worth of research, which I am more than convinced by. Changes in the atmosphere are leading to global changes. We're talking about in the SEOC meeting yesterday. Atmospheric rivers is not something we talked about in Southeast years ago. The changes that are happening in Northwest Alaska, where sea ice is binding to shores later, melting of permafrost, all of those things have got scientific research tied to additional carbon in the atmosphere. Barring that research, even just not looking at that, the economic trends of those impacts on natural disasters and on wildfires is something that's increasing. And I think as the operating budget chair, looking at how do we fund our changing needs is appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mears. I want to take a quick brief at ease. We are back on record in House Resources. I just want to note that we do have invited testimony on the line. Rick Steiner of Oasis Earth is here, so we'll proceed with invited testimony, and if there are further questions afterward, we can address them then. Mr. Steiner, please put yourself on record and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
All right, excellent. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to comment briefly on HB 247, as this bill would be a historic investment in Alaska's future. I offer my strongest support for its passage. In summary, my testimony will be this. Climate disasters in Alaska are increasing, fact. Impacts and costs are increasing, and this will go on throughout this century. Alaska communities know exactly what they need to do to better prepare for and to prevent the worst impacts of these. They already know this. They just need the money to do so. The feds cannot be relied on to continue to cover response costs into the future. And by the way, FEMA almost always pays for response, not for prevention and preparedness. HB 247 starts to fill the pipeline here, provide that sort of money that our communities desperately need to prevent storms like Halong and Murbach from becoming the disasters that they became. And it's time to put Alaskans to work solving this, either climate hardening in the communities or relocating. There are several communities that cannot be saved where they presently are, and I think we know which ones those are. And I think it's time for the legislature to stop looking away from this issue. And the question, the end question here would be, if not this bill, then what? Where, what would be the revenue stream we would pull from to help these communities? We need government's responsibilities to look out for the well-being of its citizenry, and this is one way to do it. Very quickly, climate disasters we know are increasing. Some are very fast-moving, like storms, floods, wildfires, landslides. And some are very slow-moving, like permafrost thaws, subsidence, fish and wildlife declines, and such. But all could be devastating and costly. These will get worse throughout the century, and lives and livelihoods are at stake. Estimates of costs in Alaska vary from over this the remainder of the century vary from $4 to $5 billion in climate costs. If there's adequate mitigation measures, adaptation measures put in place, that cost cuts in half. That's pretty significant savings of billions of dollars. And the 1-to-6 ratio that Representative Josephson and Joe Behan mentioned earlier is solid. That's a solid estimate, regardless. While we can't prevent these storms like Heilong and Murbach, we can prevent them from becoming the disasters that they have become. If we had had adequate mitigation in place before Heilong, as Representative Josephson said, much of that damage simply would not have occurred. Alaska communities desperately need substantial government support to do what they can to better prepare for and to prevent the worst impacts. That's precisely what HB 247 begins to do. We need to get the money in the hands of Alaskans. Lots of jobs are created by this bill. And put Alaskans to work doing what we know how to do. We're not going to stand by with our hands in our pockets and watch our communities fall apart and houses drift away into the Bering Sea. We're going to do what we can. So we need state support. Our communities need state support to do that. So to borrow from the movie Jerry Maguire, it's now time for you, the Alaska legislature, to show us the money. Other states, as Representative Josephson mentioned, are doing just that. Hawaii, New York, Vermont have climate funds. Maryland, Massachusetts, California, New Jersey, legislatures all have climate fund bills pending and in consideration. The Hawaii Climate Fund that Representative Josephson mentioned earlier, the fee, the tourism fee tax, just went into effect earlier this month, January 1, and it raised the hotel tax from 0.75% to 11%. So it raised its tax on its primary industry, the state of Hawaii, over 10% to ostensibly, hopefully, in the state of Hawaii's view, taking $100 million a year to fund its climate adaptation program. By comparison, HB 247 proposes a 20 cent per barrel fee tax on oil in Alaska, and that's about 0.3%. of a $60 per barrel oil price. So Hawaii's raised its tax 10%. HB 247 proposes to raise the tax here far less than 1% on oil. Without doubt, too, Alaska is at far more greater risk from climate disasters than any state in the nation. And we, as we've mentioned, we can no longer rely on federal government to pay 100% of our needs. FEMA may go away and may start paying 50%, leaving the rest of the burden on states. We'll have to see. HB 247 funds can be used to leverage and match federal funds to draw in more federal support. And importantly, the state has already identified much of what needs to be done. The legislature's own climate commission in 2006 and 2007 identified many of these things. The Palin subcabinet, with their immediate action working group and the Alaska climate change strategy, and identified many of the measures that need to be put into place. But then the state has done absolutely nothing since then to prepare for or prevent the worst impacts of this, and that's to me and to many of us, many of our friends in Western Alaska, that represents a catastrophic failure in government. Today, you all have a chance to correct this tragic failure. The 20 cent a barrel fee, I think Representative Josephson mentioned, would be about $30+ million a year. And importantly, this is that money goes directly to jobs in Alaska communities across the state. Let's not forget that. Also, you might, in conclusion, Senator Murkowski recently said after Halon that the time to have dealt with this would have been 20 years ago. The best time and the next best time is right now. So we have a chance to do that. You have a chance to do that today. You know, we cannot kick the can down the road on this issue any longer. If not this bill and this revenue stream, then what? Again, government's responsibility, its sole responsibility, is to look out for the well-being of its citizenry. If we're not looking at climate change impacts to our communities, then we are failing, tragically. And, you know, if we can't come together to do this at this point in time, then I'd say shame on all of us. So I'll just respectfully ask that you all move this bill to the floor, have a robust debate, and move it to passage, and then hopefully the governor will sign it. I'll close with that and be available for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Yeah. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Steiner, I've received numerous communications from you over the years asking for legislation very similar to this. I'm just curious to ask, for the record, what role did you play in crafting, guiding, and advancing this particular bill this time around?
None whatsoever. I sent my bills, as you know, Representative Sadler, to every legislator, my proposals, for the last at least 10 years each year. And it was a somewhat slightly different version than what Representative Josephson drafted and introduced. My proposal was that the Department of Community and Regional Affairs administer the grant. DCRA used to have a program called the Alaska Climate Change Impact Mitigation Program, ACCIMP. That funding has gone away. That it might, in my view, it seems like DCRA might be a more logical, this is more of a community infrastructure and housing issue than it is an environmental issue. So you know, that's pretty much it. And again, I started proposing this 19 years ago when Senator Murkowski said the best time to have dealt with this would have been 20 years ago. That's indeed what I tried to do. Here we are today. Had we done that then, established a fund, and invested properly in adaptation, mitigation, and prevention, I think we'd be pretty well done with it by now, and the damage caused it by Halon and Murbach simply would have been much, much less. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair, to Mr. Steiner. So you'd mentioned, one of us mentioned, the Hawaii fund source is through tourism dollars. You'd also mentioned there are similar funds set up in Vermont and New York and perhaps other places as well. Do you know where they're looking to fund these funds?
Yeah, through the chair, yes, I believe they're all funded through an oil surcharge. Even though there is not, many of these states are not oil producing states, except for Hawaii's. Hawaii's is a tourism tax, flat, plain and simple. It's they're taxing their, and I think instead of looking at it as a punitive tax, and in some places I think they are looking at it as a punitive tax, regarding oil production or oil use. But Hawaii did not look at their tourism tax as a punitive tax on tourism, although tourism does have a climate footprint, a carbon footprint, no question about it. But they're looking at it as a logical revenue stream. If not tourism, then where? Where can that money come from to government to take care of this very legitimate need of its citizenry? And I think that's primarily the view that I have with a oil surcharge here in Alaska, that's not necessarily a punitive tax, it's looking at this is a logical place to get a revenue stream to start taking care of our communities in Western and Northern and Interior Alaska. We have to find a place for it from somewhere. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, you mentioned Hawaii taxes tourism. And if one accepts the argument, which for this purpose I will, the tax on tourism gets to the root cause of the need for a response. Were it not for tourism, all the infrastructure that you need to protect would never have been built in the extreme, or it would have been built differently. So why don't we take that approach on taxing the direct consumption that is causing the need for people or, yeah, locate out in a particular spot? Tourism being one, you would... A fishing lodge needs to be built next to a body of water that is at greater exposure to damage from flooding, weather-caused events. So why would we not take that approach to disincentivize the activities that cause the need for the response? If there wasn't something there, you wouldn't need to respond. Why would we not take that approach to make it directly, more directly caused or connected to the cause of the need for the response?
I don't know if that question was directed toward...
To Mr. Steiner.
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Steiner.
Through the chair... if I understand your question correctly, and I'm not positive that I do, sure, there's various revenue models that one could consider, that the committee could consider, that the legislature could consider. But the bottom line is we have to find substantial revenues from the state of Alaska to begin dealing with preparation and prevention and mitigation for these climate disasters that all of our communities, every single Alaskan, is at risk from. And that includes wildfires, landslides that are devastating and fatal oftentimes, from glacial debuttressing of unstable rock slopes, and floods and storms and wind damage. I mean, think about it. If we had that sort of funding available before HALON, and we'd been able to go in and anchor the houses to their foundations and put some more storm surge barriers around the village and maybe raise some emergency generators out of the flood zone, things like that, there would have been minimal or far less damage. So as far as a revenue model, I'd have to leave that to the economists there in the legislature and you fine folks to think through. I believe Representative Josephson chose the oil surcharge for logical reasons. I think that has always been our proposal. You could do a tourism tax. You could do an agriculture tax that wouldn't generate a lot. And other industries, you know, but I think the logical place for this to start with would be an oil surcharge. And that is what most other states are looking at this time, is my understanding. Thank you.
Thank you.
I had a question about the fiscal note.
Okay. We have Teresa Melville on the line, the director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response with the Department of Environmental Conservation. I think Representative Colomb has a question about the fiscal note. Are you on the line, Ms. Melville?
We're still uninvited.
Oh.
Through the chair, yes, I am.
Well, did you want to finish?
Oh, hold on 1 second. Does anybody else have any further questions for Mr. Steiner? Okay. We'll go ahead. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Steiner, for joining us.
Thank you for hearing my comments. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Colomb.
Thank you, Chair, and through the Chair. Ms. Melville, I'm looking at the fiscal note, and it looks like the first year it says $1.2 million for the cost of this, but then it jumps up to $11 million. And I'm not sure why is – am I reading that wrong, or can you just kind of walk through the fiscal note and how much this would cost to set up this – climate change fund?
For the record, this is Teresa Melville, Director of Divisions, the Division of Spill Prevention and Response, and representative through the chair. What we looked at is the first year of this program, we would be basically setting up the parameters, the rules, hiring staff to be able to do that. The only staff member that we did not look at putting on adding to staff would have been the accountant, because we figured that we would not have any income from this until year two, which would be FY28. If you look a little further down, the new income for that would be $11,416,000, and we looked at $10 million of that going out in grants in the first year. That's on the under FY28. It's in the upper box. Mm-hmm. And then in the second year, we would look at having more income, and then as the years progress, looking at being able to produce more grants. To be able to assist.
Follow up. So you don't think that it doesn't look like you don't have any increases over the years to the cost of administering the fund? You think it's going to be static?
Through the chair, the way that we kind of looked at it with a $33 million progression, that would, we were trying to be very safe in those estimates. So leaving it at $30 million would be the extent of the income that we would have because in addition, it says that the funding could be used for other purposes, so we did leave a little room in there.
One more follow-up. So you're anticipating the revenue that this fund is creating, that's going to be covering the cost to DEC. You would be using that money to cover the cost of administering the fund?
Through the chair, the first year we would need general fund to cover the $1.2 million, and that would be for setting up services, just putting the program in place, and then because we would have no income in the first year, and then in the second year we would have income from the surcharge and be able to use those monies, and then that would cover the grants and our operating costs.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. Representative Elam, did you have a question? Okay. Seeing no further questions, we will set this bill aside. Thank you, Representative Josephson and Mr. Meehan, for joining resources today. We're going to take a brief at ease while we set up for the next presentation.
My thanks to the cook.
We are back on record in House Resources. Next up, we have House Bill 258 from Representative Stapp. This is the first hearing on this bill in House Resources. Representative Stapp, welcome to House Resources. Please join us at the table and put yourself on record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. With your permission, I'd like to bring up my staff, too. And for the record, my name is Representative Will Stapp. I represent East Fairbanks, Fort Wainwright in Badger Road, House District 32. And this is my staff.
Good afternoon. For the record, Elizabeth Rexford, staff to Representative Stapp. Thank you.
And with the permission of the co-chairs, I'd like to be able to just give an overview of the bill and kind of what it does, and then I'll turn it over to my staff, Ms. Rexford, for the sectional. So, what is the nucleus behind HB 258, statewide spay and neuter assistance program and fund? Basically, our state struggles in more areas than I had ever thought with controlling populations of mainly cats and dogs, mainly cats, actually. Communities across Alaska, especially rural and more remote underserved communities, face ongoing challenges with uncontrolled dog and cat populations. So these challenges end up causing public health and safety issues, animal welfare issues. They put downward upward pressure on municipal budgets, animal shelter occupancies, and capacities. And the purpose of the bill is to focus on prevention rather than reaction. So, like, what's the best way to start decline in these populations is to start getting them spayed and neutered so they can't breed. So HB 58 is a idea that was brought to me by a constituent that you're going to get to hear from today. And it's designed to help reduce the long-term costs associated with these explosions in populations of feral dogs and cats. So the program, as in a nutshell, it's flexible and voluntary. It's administered by the Department of Environmental Conservation. It's designed to partner with veterinarians and nonprofits and tribal entities and municipalities and animal shelters and really most organizations that are really willing to try to tackle this problem that for so long has gone kind of unaddressed in many of the communities in Alaska. It establishes a voluntary funding mechanism and includes a special request spay and neuter license plates, which I think are really cool. I'm sure there'll be a happy picture of a dog and a cat on one of those. That's obviously pre-spay and neuter, just to let everybody know. voluntary permanent fund dividend contributions through, obviously, Pick-Click Gift. So there's a lot of, I think, people who are very passionate about animals in the state, and they'd be more than willing to help contribute to solve this problem if they had an opportunity to do so through their permanent fund dividend distribution. And, of course, donations and grants. So the funding tools are designed to really minimize the impact of the state budget, but be able to start funneling kind of needed resources to these issues in many of the communities that I think pretty much all of you at the table combined to represent. And with that, I'll take it over to Ms. Rexford for the sectional analysis.
I'll walk us through the sectional analysis. So for Section 1 creates a new section of law establishing the Statewide Spay and Neuter Assistance Program, the Statewide Spay and Neuter Assistance Fund, and the eligibility criteria for participation. It assigns the DEC responsibility for developing regulations, promoting public education awareness on the program and fund, and submitting an annual report to the legislature. Section 2 addresses the Board of Games regulatory authority to prohibit the live capture, possession, transport, or release of native or exotic game by allowing municipalities to adopt an ordinance addressing feral cats and dogs. Section 3 authorizes the creation of special request vehicle registration plates related to companion animal spay and neuter efforts. The plate design will and issuance will follow existing special request plate statutes. This creates a voluntary public-facing way for Alaskans to support the program. Section 4 sets the special request plate fee at $100 and directs the net proceeds from those plates to the Spay and Neuter Assistance Fund. Section 5 allows municipalities to adopt ordinances permitting capture, possession, and transport of feral cats and dogs for spaying, neutering, and vaccinating before release. Municipalities are not required to do this. This section just creates an option for communities that choose to pursue humane population control practices at the local level if they choose to. Section 6 is a technical and conforming change. It adds the Spay and Neuter Assistance Fund into statute under the program receipts section. This is what allows license plate revenue donations, grants, and other receipts to legally flow into the fund. For Section 7, 8, and 9, they are technical and conforming changes. Together, they add the necessary statutory language so the fund can exist on pick click give list, receive voluntary permanent fund dividend contributions. And I think I'm missing a page. These sections simply allow the fund to participate in existing PFD contributions, the voluntary PFD contribution system. Section 10 requires DEC to submit the first annual report by January 10th. Section 11 sets effective date for January 1st, 2027. This concludes the sectional analysis. Madam Co-Chair.
Are there questions for Representative Stapp? Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Representative Stapp, I'm looking at Section 3 of the bill, which says basically it's a one-time charge for the specialty plates. I think there are a lot of other specialty plates have to be issued and paid for every 2 years, unless there's an exemption. The statute would create such an exemption. Just curious, if there's a need for this money and it's an ongoing need, why would the special plate fee be a one-time only initial issuance? Kind of a technical schedule thing, but still.
Through the chair to Rep. Sadler, I thank you for the question. I'm not actually sure if you're correct. I have specialty plates on my truck, and I only bought them once. Now, I have to do the registration, but I've never had to pay a fee outside the initial time for the plates. Of course, those are Purple Heart plates. So I don't know if that's different, but I'm not aware that you would have to pay multiple fees every couple of years to hold specialty plates. I think it is just a one-time fee.
Okay. Yep, my question came up quickly. I hadn't had a chance to dive through the statute, so we'll get back into it. Thank you.
Representative Mears?
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Stapp. I'm looking at Section 5, which allows municipalities to adopt ordinances allowing for the capture, possession, and transport of feral cats and dogs for the purpose of spaying, neutering, and vaccinating before release. I believe this is known as TNR, or trap, neuter, release. Are we not allowed to do that in the state at this point?
Through the chair to Representative Mears. Okay, this is where the happy conversation turns a little sad. So fish and game regulation is catch and kill, basically. So this is, you know, this is probably a relatively challenging portion of the bill. And I just kind of want to see the need for spay-neutered resources. So it's actually a section that I'm okay with being removed. But people should know that. I think it's a good conversation to have on the record. Like, municipalities, basically, that authority is under the Board of Game currently, and that's kind of their policy through the chair.
Thank you, Representative Stapp. And just so folks know that we do have the state veterinarian from DEC on the line, Sarah Coburn. We also have Chandri Perry, the director of the Division of Environmental Health, Department of Environmental Conservation. And in the room, we have Ryan Scott, the wildlife director from ADF&G. So if there are questions for them as well. Representative Colomb? Oh, I had Dibert in the queue. Oh. And Co-Chair Dibert?
Thank you, through the co-chair. Thank you for bringing this bill forward as a co-sponsor and growing up in rural communities as a child. Our rural communities really struggle with having pets and the pets having multiple litters of puppies mainly. So any way to help communities in this way is really terrific. And I just purchased a new car and I did get a vanity plate with the nice flowers on it, the fireweed flowers, and it is a one-time payment.
Thank you, Co-Chair Dibert. Appreciate the comments and the co-sponsorship.
Representative Klum?
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair, Representative Staff, thank you for bringing this forward. I would say I live in Anchorage, and we have a definite feral cat issue. They're killing all my birds in my yard, so I appreciate it. I want to clarify what you just said. You're saying right now that the animal control in the muni, let's say in Anchorage, only gets the power to take those stray cats or dogs from Fish and Game?
Through the chair to Representative Colomb, I'm fairly positive that that's the policy of the Board of Game, but I know that there are experts in the room that I can hopefully defer to ensure that I am right in what I say, and they are nodding yes. Okay, so I'm correct okay. in my thing. I know, I was a little bit shocked, too,
yeah.
So by the way.
So, follow-up, and maybe this is a department question, but I'm not, just looking at the logistics. So for right now, is this bill telling munis they have to capture, spay, or neuter? Or continue what they're doing? Like, who decides what they do with those cats and dogs now if this passes?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Colomb, co-chair to Representative Colomb, the bill basically just allows municipalities to make up their mind on what they want to do. Currently, they don't actually have that authority. And again, I've said on the record that's actually through the Board of Game. That's where that authority comes from. So municipality doesn't actually have the authority to change the policy. And I'm going to look back and make sure that that is indeed correct. There we go.
Awesome.
So,
okay, thank you.
Just for the record.
Yeah,
so.
Thanks.
Well, we also have invited testimony, so maybe we'll proceed with invited testimony, and then if there are any further questions for the sponsor, we can address those then. So with that, we have in the room for invited testimony Nick Leginus of the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly. Mr. Leginus, please join us at the table and put yourself on record and begin your testimony.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chairs and members of the committee. My name is Nick Leginus. I'm a member of the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly, which has brought this HB 258 forward as a legislative priority for our borough. That actually went on to get support from the AML as well. I'm also the president of Straw for Dogs. It's a nonprofit organization that provides resources to dogs living outside all over Alaska to provide free insulated dog houses, straw, veterinary care, rehoming, live trapping of lost pets, and food, all being done with unpaid volunteers. I'm here today because I genuinely believe that Alaska will be a better place with the passage of HB 258, the statewide spay and neuter program. As a lifelong 53-year resident of North Pole, I am no stranger to the challenges of living life in interior Alaska, but Alaska is vast and every region, coastal, rural, urban, faces its own unique hardships. We design solutions to meet those specific challenges where we live and work. Today, I want to call your attention to a problem that many Alaskans may not see every day, but one that affects every region of our state, including the communities each of you all represent. And it sounds like some of you are familiar with this problem. Alaska is quietly facing a compounding consequences of overpopulation of stray and unwanted animals. These consequences are real and serious. Bites on and injuries on humans, spread of harmful and sometimes deadly disease, health and behavioral problems amongst animals due to inbreeding, significant financial strains on communities and families, generational trauma for children that are being exposed to animal suffering, and alarming rates of burnout, compassion fatigue, and even suicide amongst volunteer animal advocates. While this problem is most visible in rural communities where veterinary care is often limited or non-existent, we'd be naive to believe it does not affect the entire state. Alaskans are known for helping one another, Even when we disagree with our neighbors, we step up to help when someone is in need. Living in extreme conditions teaches us that our actions or inactions can have immediate consequences. That value of looking out for our neighbor runs deep in our state, but I'm here to tell you it doesn't compare to what our nonprofits are capable of doing and the devotion they put in to animal advocacy. Let me be clear, our network of nonprofit rescues and municipal shelters are not failing, quite the opposite. These organizations are driven by passion, ingenuity, and sheer determination. They routinely accomplish the impossible with limited resources. Many of you witnessed this firsthand when animal welfare groups rallied during the Typhoon Halong, risking their own safety to rescue 218 dogs, animals whose owners were instructed to leave behind. Over the decades, these groups have built extraordinary partnerships with veterinarians, air carriers, shipping companies, and with each other. Flights have been diverted from scheduled flight plans to pick up injured animals, flown into Anchorage or Fairbanks to receive emergency veterinary care. They make these things happen, generally often and in time-sensitive situations, 365 days a year. They do this without complaint, but even the strongest army needs reinforcements. Our animal advocates are fighting a battle that cannot be won through rescue alone. They need prevention. This is why I'm bringing you not just a problem, but a solution. HB 258 is that solution. By supporting spay and neuter services statewide, this bill addresses the root cause of animal overpopulation, reduces long-term costs to communities, improves public health and safety, and eases the emotional and financial burden carried by volunteers and municipalities alike. On behalf of your constituents and on behalf of those who cannot speak for themselves, I respectfully ask for your support on HB 258. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Legionis. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Mears?
Thank you, through the chair. Thanks for being here. We got to meet earlier, and I shared that I'd been a foster and fostered well over 100 cats. I wanted to ask specifically about the TNR. There is one cat that I had in all that fostering that, like, no quarter with humans. and I understand the desire from a rescue organization there. I really feel that. But I also appreciate the perspective of Fish and Game, and I'll like hear from them about that later. But what are your thoughts on that particular aspect of the bill?
Yeah, so you know, ideally it would be nice to, if when there are feral or stray dogs and cats that they are captured, you know, spayed or neutered, and then you know, be able to be adopted out. Ideally, that would be great. But with the way some of the animal population control is being taken care of now, in certain situations where, you know, that wouldn't be the case, I think through time, hopefully we won't have that bad of a stray and overpopulation.
Follow up?
Thank you, through the chair. So, how strong are your feelings about including that provision in the bill for TNR?
No, I'm for removing that part of the bill. Absolutely.
Trap, neuter, release. Thank you. Seeing no further questions, are there? Oh, Representative Prox.
Well, first question: is there additional invited testimony?
No.
Oh, okay. Forget. So, yes, through the chair, no question at all that there is a problem that needs to be addressed. My reservation with this bill is that it sets up a state-administered agency to do the work. And in Fairbanks or the North Pole, North Star Borough area, there are quite a few quite a number of animal rescue agencies. There was one at She was underfunded, I think, overpassioned and underfunded. But nobody complained about her being there for about 20 years until it just got ahead of her. As opposed to, there's quite a few complaints about spending $30 million on a new dog pound. So we get resistance, just automatic resistance when the government does something. And I have to admit that seems like great plenty of money to spend to spend on a dog pound. So is there some way to have the funding source, maybe even an organization that is not associated with all of the regulations that go along with it when you get either the state or the local governments involved?
Through the chair to Representative Prox, it sounds like the question is there other funding sources other than the Picklick Give and the license plates?
Well, yeah, sort of. There are lots of different funding sources. My reservation is the part of this that brings the state into the distribution, because then there's going to be regulations. And
I think I better understand your question now. So what we have in what we have going on right now is I kind of mentioned it as an army of nonprofits, if you will, currently doing this work through the Compassion, through donated funds, through fundraising, and things like, you know, setting up spay and neuter clinics. You know, for example, they'll have, you know, an announcement for a community to say Bethel, hey, we're going to have a spay and neuter clinic this weekend. Make sure you round up all your neighbors, bring their animals in. We're going to go to the high school gymnasium floor, and we're going to, you know, spay and neuter a bunch of. So yes, this work is currently being done by an army of very passionate people, and I think that it's not hodgepodge. It's all. It's each individual nonprofit, by golly, just doing what we can. With the program, there will be some orchestration. I think it is important to have, you know, typically anytime you get, you know, state or government involved. I respect what you're trying to say there, Mr. Prax, but I think in this case, to put up this program, to have some structure, some orchestration amongst the groups that are already, you know, chomping at the bit to attack this thing, I think it'll just make it that more efficient and get the compounding results that we're all looking for.
Thank you. Are there any further questions for Mr. Legynas? Seeing none, thank you so much. I believe Representative Mears has a question for Mr. Scott. Mr. Scott, if you'll join us at the table, state your name for the record and wait for the question. Thank you.
Thank you, through the chair. I imagine there's two pieces to this, one you feel really good about and the other one maybe not so much. Could you share with us how you're feeling on generally the whole encouragement of spaying and neutering, as well as if you can convey, I know it's if it's a Board of Game issue, it might not be yours, but what concerns are with returning spayed and neutered animals once they've can no longer reproduce?
Through the chair, Representative Mears, for the record, my name is Ryan Scott. I'm the director with the Division of Wildlife Conservation for Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Two good questions. One is certainly I think that the primary concern of the department is feral cats and dogs. There's other species as well, and the impacts that it's having to on wildlife populations. We had an example of birds, but small mammals are also a significant concern. Larger mammals with dogs, you can imagine that big dogs have the ability to actually take larger game animals. So any opportunity to slow that reproduction is good. The focus is good. And I think that this is a problem that's recognized worldwide. Certainly is talked about a lot, lots of literature about it, lots of estimates on the number of birds and small mammals that are killed by specifically feral dogs and cats in the United States. The challenge is the Board of Game Regulations, where the legislature has given authority to the board to promulgate regulations involving game. When we talk about feral animals, they're considered game animals under Alaska statute, and then we have several regulations that address them. It's very clear in the administrative code that these animals can't be captured and then re-released out into the out into the wild, or I'm going to use the word public as well. Obviously, the legislature can make that change should you like to do that. But that's the crux of the department's concern. There is a regulation. There's also a biological component and a concern. I can tell you that the Board of Game has received numerous requests like this to provide for trap capture. Trap, neuter, spay, and release. It's never been adopted by the board.
Follow up? Thank you, through the chair. So does the Board of Game have the ability to make that decision now to allow the return of animals, or is that in statute?
Through the chair, Representative Mears, they do have the ability. It's actually in regulation. Again, 5 AAC 92029.
Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, does that regulation apply to individuals that might be trapping, or we will assume live trapping, strays? They have a live trap by their garage, and we're not supposed to release them?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, that's correct. It does apply to individuals.
I better plead the fifth from this point.
Me too.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions for any of for anybody? For Mr. Scott, Mr. Legines, or the bill sponsor? Seeing none, thank you. Representative Stapp and Mr. Legines and
thank you.
The departments for joining us here today. We are going to set an amendment deadline for House Bill 258 to Friday, February 6th at 11 a.m. and we'll plan on public testimony that same day. That completes the agenda for House Resources Committee meeting today. Our next House Resources Committee meeting is Wednesday, February 4, 2026. Where we will hold an introductory hearing on House Bill 271 from Representative Fields related to royalties in the kitchen lights unit of Cook Inlet and receive a related presentation from Hex Fury. The time now is 2:55 p.m. and this hearing at the House Resources Committee is now adjourned.